This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear an update on what's happening in Guantanamo, including Supreme Court arguments on December 5th.
6 years later, we're still fighting to get our clients, the Guantanamo detainees, a day in court. Let's hope it happens finally.
We'll also run down a number of significant updates.
The week has had its ups and downs, some great news and some sad news.
We'll talk with one of the authors of the newly released book, Less Safe, Less Free, Why America is Losing the War on Terror.
Jules Lobel, in his new book, criticizes the preventive paradigm, the idea that, much like the movie in Minority Report, you can anticipate crime, arrest, and stop the people before they actually commit it.
A question of impeachment. We'll talk with creative director of the Culture Project about events that are happening there.
The Culture Project has a great poster. It says, Congress took it off the table. We put it on the stage. We're asking all of you, go to the Culture Project.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. Our own Michael Ratner was awarded the Creative Citizen Award by the Nation Institute and the Puffin Institute, and he's being honored on December 10th for the work that he's been doing against the encroaching police state. So congratulations, Michael. We'll be there at the ceremony, and if everybody else wants to come to it, they should call the Nation Institute. Although I warn you, if you don't get a free ticket, it's really expensive.
It's really for taking risks, for doing that kind of thing, being brave, supposedly, but it's really about the Center for Constitutional Rights in many ways, because that's, I mean, my work is really a reflection of their work, and they've done a great job. So we're really happy.
You're
for
too
the
modest, Michael. Well, congratulations.
You are too modest, Michael, and we're really proud of
a
you.
Great honor.
It's age. You get old enough, they give you awards. Anyway, thank you, guys.
Well, we have some good news. The United Nations panel adopted a resolution calling for a moratorium on the death penalty. This happened, I think, last week. The full 192-member General Assembly was widely expected to endorse the decision next month. But we've been seeing all around the country states postponing executions because of the pending Supreme Court decision on lethal injections and whether it violates the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment.
Why would that be, Heidi?
They're saying that actually people have felt pain during the injections, so that they're suffering and that's unconstitutional.
And actually, the case is going to be argued in January in the Supreme Court. It's pretty shocking they took the case. And it's not on whether lethal injection is actually unconstitutional and violates the Eighth Amendment cruel treatment clause. It's really on the process for determining whether or not it's cruel treatment. But it's a big case. And what's interesting about the court now is some states are continuing to want to go ahead with executions. And at the last minute, those cases get appealed to the court, and the court is stopping those executions. So you're in a period that you haven't been in really since the late 60s or early 70s, when every execution in the United States is being halted. It was 1976 when they lifted the halt, thousands of people on death row. But so we're in that period. I can't say we're optimistic or not. I don't know. You know, it's a very moderate conservative. A moderate would be too strong a word, good a word. It's a very conservative court on this issue, so we can't say how it's going to come out.
But it's a nice trend to see after so long, where actually public opinion has gradually been going against the death penalty as more people become aware of actually how it's imposed arbitrarily from state to state.
And yesterday I read an article that New Jersey is planning to repeal their death penalty law. I think no one's been executed in New Jersey in some 40 years. There's still people on death row. But essentially, I think they're going to repeal the law. That would be a huge thing.
Huge
thing. You know, the death penalty is applied mainly to people of color, mainly to poor persons. I don't think a wealthy person has ever been executed in this country. And usually it's applied against people who've had really crappy representation. You know, attorneys who are drunk or asleep, those are the people that get executed. That's only one of the things wrong with the death penalty. A civilized society shouldn't kill anybody. So let's hope that goes through.
Following up on a story that we aired recently about the Khalil Gibran School in Brooklyn and Debbie Almontazer, the founding principal who was ousted, she's just filed a lawsuit.
By her attorney, Alan Levine, the civil rights attorney here, they're claiming violation of the First Amendment. She was the founder of the school and about to become the principal when she was asked about a kid who was wearing a T-shirt that said Intifada on it. And she explained that Intifada in Arabic means shaking off.
Intifada, yeah. NYC.
Yeah. So neocons and the Zionists and a good part of the Jewish leadership in this city, to their everlasting shame, got this woman fired. And it's wonderful to see attorneys like Alan Levine and the whole community, particularly people of color out in Brooklyn and around New York, coming together to support her. And let's hope she gets her job back.
Well, and just so listeners know, she reapplied for her job after she was ousted and was rejected outright by Chancellor Joel Klein and District Superintendent Rosemary Stewart. They're named in the lawsuit, as are Mayor Bloomberg and Deputy Mayor Dennis Walcott, claiming they pressured her to resign.
Good luck, Debbie. And speaking of the bad guys, the same kind of reactionary forces that got the principal fired in Brooklyn are trying to get Joel Covell's book, Overcoming Zionism, which posits the setting up of a single democratic state that doesn't favor any one religion or people in Palestine, Israel. Joel wrote the book. Pluto Press published it. The University of Michigan distributed it. A outfit called Stand With Us, which is run by a right-wing Christian Zionist. It's an outgrowth of Campus Watch, was a thought police outfit. This organization pressured the University of Michigan. They dropped the book temporarily. We formed a committee called Committee for Open Discussion of Zionism. The University of Michigan Press Board met and unanimously agreed on First Amendment grounds to restore this book to their list. The University of Michigan Daily signed an editorial. Every editor said, absolutely, Michigan, you're right. We stand behind you. Well, the Zionist thought police were not to be dissuaded. They organized the Board of Regents, which runs the school and the press, met last week Thursday and voted 3-7 to get rid of the book. So we were hanging on by our teeth. The B'nai B'rith, the Anti-Defamation League, and Campus Watch showed up at the meeting and got 3 out of the 7 votes. So they got defeated, but you got to drive a wooden stake through their heart, because they came back the next week and they found another Board of Regents guy who would be on their side. So now it's divided 4-4. We don't know what's going to happen. Pluto Press's contract expires in June of 08. We're hoping they'll extend it. But I have to say, without a huge mobilization of forces like we did the first time, it ain't going to happen. And they're going to succeed in getting a book suppressed.
Is Joel Covell doing book signing tours around the country, Michael?
And around the world. Absolutely. He just got back from Ireland. He's going out to California.
And how can listeners get a hold of him or go to a signing if they want?
We'll put his contact information on our website. It's a tremendous book. As you know, Heidi, when he appeared at the Lawyers Guild Convention 2 weeks ago, to my mind, it was one of the highlights of the convention. If he's in your area, go see him. You can get Overcoming Zionism. It still hasn't been suppressed. You can get it on the internet or ask your local bookstore. Joel Covell, Overcoming Zionism.
We have some sad news to report. Victor Rabinowitz, who was one of the founding members of the National Lawyers Guild, a very well-known civil rights socialist lawyer in New York, died a few days ago.
He was 96 years old. He had been a lawyer for the movement for almost 3/4 of a century. Michael knew him. I knew him.
Heidi knew him.
Heidi knew him. Michael almost went to work for his law firm, which was a famous law firm. He did so much good work that it's not fair just to mention it. We're planning a special program on Victor Rabinowitz. There'll be a memorial meeting for him, and we'll cover it here on Law and Disorder.
When the Guild was founded in 1937, Victor being one of the founders, it was an alternative to the American Bar Association, which would not allow African Americans into it. And the Guild was founded really as an alternative to that, plus, of course, for issues of social progress. It's a major loss for all of us. He was really a model for all the hosts on this show. We really miss Victor.
He wrote a very good book called Unrepentant Leftist, which you can get. We promise you we'll have a special program on Viktor Rabinowitz. We salute him.
I was actually, the only thing that made me smile a little bit today is, and Viktor always used to tell the stories about meeting Che Guevara and playing chess with Che, and Leonard Boudin played chess with Che, and it was mentioned in the New York Times obituary today. And, of course, Viktor said you always had to lose to Che. And especially when they were about to get the account of Cuba to represent Cuba, I guess in the early 60s, that was a time that even though maybe Leonard Boudin or Viktor could have beaten Che, I'm not willing to say.
I think Leonard could have beaten. Leonard was a very good chess player.
But in any case, they lost to Che and they got the account is the way the story goes.
He represented hundreds of movement cases. He was the president of the Guild when I went to my first convention in 1967. Out in California. His life is something that we want to talk about because it's the kind of model for committed leftist attorneys that people should know about. And we'll be back with a special show for you on it. We have another sad passing of Mo Fishman, who was the leading force of the veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, the international brigade formed in part by Americans who went to fight against the fascist Franco takeover of the Democratic government in Spain. Mo was also 96 years old, an inspiring figure who had been campaigning to educate people about what the Abraham Lincoln Brigade accomplished throughout all of these years. I know Michael and I remember him from going to the meetings every year, and it's a sad passing. There are only a few members of the brigade left, and we salute you, Mo Fishman.
Particularly because it was a struggle that could have made the difference, but because of the role of the United States and some other countries, did not. I mean, they tried to defeat Franco, which was the opening phase of the fascist takeover of Europe, and they were unable to do so in part because of the role of the United States.
Well,
not
Hitler
supporting
was
them.
Supporting Franco, and the United States put an arms embargo on the Republican government of Spain.
These are real heroes, and so we're really sad to see Mo is not with us. Today we're going to give you an update on what's going on at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. On December 5th, there's going to be an argument in the Supreme Court on whether or not they have a right to go into court and challenge their detention, what's called the writ of habeas corpus. There was also a recent release of a manual called the Standard Operating Procedures Manual for Camp Delta. Pretty interesting stuff in that about some ghost detainees. There's also some information about some briefs that have been filed in the European Court of Human Rights regarding particularly Bosnian clients who were picked up, despite Bosnia saying they should not be picked up by the United States. Joining us today to talk about these and other stories about Guantanamo is Shane Katadal, senior attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Shane, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Shane, a major Supreme Court argument is being taken to the court in D.C. by the Center on December 5th. Tell us what's at stake.
Well, it's about the ability of the president to lock people up without having to respond to the judicial branch at all, to ever have to come into court and justify why he has the people detained. This is the third visit to the court for the Guantanamo detainees. The first time was in 2004 when the court said that under the existing sort of habeas corpus statute that the detainees who were held at Guantanamo had the right to challenge their detention in court. The second time was in 2006 when Salim Hamdan, who was subject to trial by military commission, successfully challenged the authority of the president to just create military commissions and try people sort of out of thin air, even though Congress had already created a statute that allowed people to be tried for war crimes. And of course, there are all sorts of domestic statutes that allow you to be tried in federal courts, regular federal courts, criminal courts for terrorism-related offenses. Well, that was a little bit of a case of, be careful what you wish for, because the response of Congress was to pass the Military Commissions Act, which kind of placed Congress's blessing on both military commissions of the sort that the president had, initially created just by executive order, and then also attempted to withdraw the jurisdiction of the federal courts to even hear these cases for all the other detainees, the vast majority of people who are never going to be subject to a military commission. So the question now is, do the detainees have some sort of constitutional right to review by a court that even Congress can't take away from them?
Well, what's wrong with not giving these terrorists habeas corpus rights? You think that somehow this is connected to the rights of American citizens here?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, because the, you know, the first factual question is someone really a terrorist? You know, the reality at Guantanamo is that the vast majority of these people, you know, not only are not terrorists, but also, you know, likely the majority of them weren't even fighting against the U.S. So if you look at the military's own sort of military panels that it convened after the 2004 decision to kind of rubber stamp all of these detentions with some sort of, you know, veneer or illusion of process, even those panels claimed that only 8% of the detainees were in any way sort of even affiliated or associated loosely with al-Qaeda. And then 95% of the detainees weren't even picked up by the United States. You know, most of them were picked up or brought to Guantanamo at a time when the U.S. was paying pretty large bounties, you know, $5,000 a head, 20 years' wages, basically, you know, for anybody who supposedly affiliated with the Taliban government or, you know, basically anyone who was a foreigner in Afghanistan. So a lot of these people ended up coming into to U.S. detention through these big profiling sweeps, essentially sold by bounty hunters or hungry villagers or rival warlords. And so it's really the factual innocence of a lot of these people is the first question that we've got to get in front of a court. But most of the lawyers feel that if they ever get their day in court, that the government won't be able to respond, that it'll just have to let the detainees go.
Well, is denying them habeas corpus any kind of qualitative break with past tradition?
Well, certainly it is. I mean, you know, the historical questions here are kind of important. You know, the Constitution says that that habeas can't be suspended except in times of invasion or rebellion, and nobody is claiming that that's the case here. So the question is really, do these detainees have the sort of habeas corpus rights that the founders would have envisioned when they wrote that provision into the Constitution way back in 1789, or should we, you know, maybe think that over the course of two centuries that traditions have sort of evolved to the point where you know should think that this is a constitutionally guaranteed minimum to allow people in this sort of situation, you know, detained very far from active combat in a place that the U.S. completely controls like Guantanamo, you know, should they always have habeas corpus rights even if Congress tries to take them away? You know, and obviously in this situation, Congress, the same party as the president in 2006, the same sort of concerns are there. That 2004, the court was concerned that the executive might try to cover up its incompetence or its misconduct by, you know, keeping people in permanent detention and hiding them from the courts. Some of the same incentives are there for the, you know, Republican Party Congress people that voted to take away habeas essentially in 2006.
Shane, when do you expect a decision on this?
Well, you know, the case will be argued on December 5th. I think the soonest we could probably expect a decision is about 2 months, given the time it takes to write the opinions and the dissents. The longest it would probably take is up till the summer when the term ends. And usually the modern court's been pretty good about getting every last decision out before the term ends, although there's no guarantee of that either.
Shane, my own view, given the composition of the Supreme Court, is that we've got to fight for everything, and I'm not sure we're going to prevail on this. And what I'm worried about is that if we don't prevail, they're able to get away with this historic break from the past and not give somebody their day in court, that this would impact not just on foreigners but on American citizens as well. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, I mean, there have already been sort of American citizens who've fallen into this rabbit hole. There's a case going on right now of a resident alien, Khalid Al-Mari, Ali Al-Mari, who's been in detention now, I think, 3-4 years without, you know, having his day in court. Yasser Hamdi, who is a U.S. citizen who was supposedly picked up on the battlefield by the time the courts finally decided that he had that his day in court was coming, the government hastily negotiated his release. Jose Padilla, who was picked up at O'Hare Airport, you know, the government charged him basically days before the Supreme Court would have decided whether or not it was going to hear the merits of his case. Pretty much a slippery slope. And one of the things that we said in our at the very opening of our brief to the Supreme Court was that if the Court of Appeals decision is allowed to stand here, that that basically the government can avoid judicial review just by keeping people prisoner outside of the, you know, boundaries of the 50 states. The implications of that decision, obviously, are very, very troubling. Not just for U.S. citizens, but for anybody.
Shane, we have a few other issues we wanted to ask you about. One is the supposed leaking of the Camp Delta Standard Operating Procedures Manual. Can you tell us what happened?
It dates back to the spring of 2003, and at that time, nobody really knew too much about the detainees. There hadn't been a lot of people released. We didn't really know about the sort of Abu Ghraib-style abuse that was going on at the time. But the guy who, you know, sort of ran interrogation operations at, or detainee operations at Guantanamo and then later at Abu Ghraib, Major Jeffrey Miller.
Camp Delta is Guantanamo, right?
Right. And, you know, he had been telling reporters at the time the Red Cross had basically unlimited access to all the detainees. And it turns out from looking at this manual that appears to, you know, have been, you flat-out lie. Because
they
weren't
allowed any access.
Well, it varied. The manual sets out four different categories of detainees at Guantanamo. It says that there are people who can have unlimited access, but then there are also people who can only answer questions related to their health. Then there are people who can only be visually inspected, and the Red Cross can't actually talk to them. So it can look at them, but it can't talk to them. And then there's a no-access category. So that's the most interesting thing that comes out of this sort of manual leak. But there are all sorts of other little crazy bits along the way, considered sort of vandalization of property to do anything to the styrofoam cups that they would give people to drink out of. And it's just curious because, you know, there was a book of poetry published of poems of detainees at Guantanamo, and, you know, the introduction talks about how people would write poems by etching them into styrofoam cups. This is maybe a way to cut off people from writing poetry down there as well.
It reminds me of that wonderful scene in the movie Dr. Strangelove when they have to get a quarter, and they can't find a quarter because they got to make a call to stop the atomic bomb from going off.
Right.
And so they bash a Coke machine to get a quarter out of it, and the general says, "You can't touch that. That's private property."
Right.
You know, I mean, it's that mindset that they were saying that the detainees who were so desperate that they took their own lives at Guantanamo were destroying property.
Well, it reminds me of the situation we had recently with trying to navigate Majid Khan's case. Department of Defense's ethics division said that we couldn't donate a computer so that we could use it at the secure facility to type up notes about classified information.
Now, you've said a lot just there, so I just want you to go through each step. One, who is Majid Khan? What's a secure facility? And what's the center's involvement?
Sure. Well, Majid Khan is first of the former ghost detainees still in detention to see a lawyer. We took on his case through his family, some sense that he might have disappeared into CIA ghost detention. He was apparently sort of swooped up by, you know, parties unknown in Pakistan in 2003. Then the next he was heard from was when President Bush announced after the Hamdan decision that he was moving 14 so-called high-value detainees, basically 14 former ghost detainees, out of the CIA detention system and into Guantanamo, and that he was shutting down the secret CIA detention system. That turned out to be a lie because a number of other detainees were moved to Guantanamo who, you know, in all likelihood in the CIA ghost detention system as well. So Khan was at Guantanamo, and for many months after we filed an initial habeas case, we couldn't get the courts to enter a protective order in his case. And what the government was basically saying in opposition to that, and again, sorry, the protective order is what governs the conditions under which you'll have access to the detainees. And there's one in every case where a Guantanamo detainee is being visited. And the reason is that the government says anything any one of these detainees tells you is presumptively classified. So you go and meet with the person, and they tell you something, that knowledge that sits in your head is presumptively classified. And in order,
are you
to
allowed
it,
to take notes when you're...
You are, and those notes have to be shipped back to the mainland by the military, and they go to a secure facility in Washington, D.C., and there somebody from a Department of Justice privilege team reads it and decides what can be cleared and what has to be redacted. Now, the classified information can always be submitted to the court in classified form, but the question is really what can come out publicly, right? So you have to get things unclassified in order to share them with the news media, in some situations to share them with you know, sort of other counsel working on these cases and so forth. So, you know, if you go home, you know, from a visit at the base and something pops into your head, some great idea about a legal claim, you can't just scribble it down on your notepad next to your nightstand. You have to travel to Washington, D.C., go to the secure facility and type it up on their computers and ask the privilege team to declassify it if you want to use it publicly.
You mean to say you can't take any notes at all once you leave Guantanamo unless you're in the secure facility? You can't
take
anything that pops into your head?
Right, because
that's
the knowledge in your head is presumptively classified.
Oh, my heavens.
Yeah, now, this applies across the board, and I don't know that people have such a great sense that this was what the situation was from 2004 onwards. This applies to everybody at Guantanamo, including, you know, the chicken farmer who was picked up by bounty hunters. But the government said that in Majid Khan's case, as a former you know, CIA ghost detainee, that they couldn't, you know, that the information in his head was even more classified, that it reached this level of top secret, not just regular secret, that applies to all the other detainees. And beyond that, to top secret, sensitive compartmentalized information. You know, the idea there is that some things are so secret that an individual sort of CIA agent can't be trusted to know all of it. So a single document might be cut up into little pieces, and that CIA agent would know only the fractions of that knowledge that he needed to know for whatever he was doing, and maybe two or three people at the top of each agency would be allowed to see the whole document. So they're saying that everything out of Majid Khan's head, essentially, falls into this category. And the two things that they said in their public motion on this were that the location of secret CIA detention facilities was super secret and therefore, you know, had to be subject to higher security procedures, and then also coercive interrogation techniques that the president said that these detainees were subject to, that those sort of techniques also were sort of super secret. So we had to, you know, go through a long process of negotiation where the government really had all the leverage. They said, we're not going to let you visit your client unless you give us, you know, even higher level security procedures. And so our two lawyers who, you know, eventually did visit him last month had to get upgraded to top secret clearance, had to get lectured about all these new procedures. Government had to build all new sort of secure facilities for them. And so that's where they're at right now. There's basically one room within the secure facility in D.C. that is a room where they can work with the notes from this top secret detainee.
The amicus brief that the center filed in Europe, just a couple of lines, what is that?
Sure. Well, the case is more interesting, I think, than the brief. The brief really just kind of lays out, you know, an awful lot of the sort of, you know, raw facts about Guantanamo.
Where's it filed?
It's filed in the European Court of Human Rights, which is, you know, something that was created kind of as part of this whole sort of, you know, European Union sort of set of treaties. You know, entrants into the European Union have to conform themselves to human rights standards and subject themselves to the jurisdiction of the European Court if they want to be part of the economic union. So, you know, a lot of the states in Eastern Europe have a big incentive to conform themselves to these human rights standards. And one of the big issues that they have is that they've also been cooperating with the secret detention programs. So we know that there were CIA prisons in Poland. This is going to become a big problem for Poland getting into the EU economically. You know, the situation with the name plaintiffs, Boumediene plaintiffs, who are whose name is on the title of the Supreme Court case that's being argued this next month, they basically were taken into detention at the behest of the U.S. by the Bosnian government. And the Bosnian Supreme Court said there's not enough evidence to hold these guys. You have to let them go. And so the U.S. insisted that after they were let go, that the Bosnian government pick them right back up again and turn them over to the U.S., and then we ship them to Guantanamo. So that case, basically, of the Bosnian government's kind of complicity in their detention in Guantanamo is before the ECHR right now.
Visit the center's website on this. There's a huge campaign going on about Guantanamo. The new website is what, Shane?
It's ccrjustice.org. So ccrjustice is one word.
.org. And the old one will get you there. It's a new campaign called Beyond Guantanamo. It's really closing Guantanamo down, but it's also regaining a lot of lost rights. So thank you very much, Shane, for being with us. It's more information even than I, who know this stuff, can practically absorb because so much is going on. So thanks again.
Thanks, Shane.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
As real as it seems, the American dream ain't nothing but another calculated scheme to get us locked up, shot up and back in chains, to deny us of the future, rob our name, kept my history a mystery, but now I see the American dream wasn't meant for me, cause Lady Liberty's a hypocrite, she lied to me, promised for freedom, education, equality, never gave me nothing but slavery, and now look at how dangerous you made me, calling me a madman, cause I'm strong and bold, with this scuffle of knowledge of the lies you told, promised me emancipation, and this new nation, all you ever gave my people was salvation, fathers of this country never cared for me, they kept my ancestors shackled up in slavery, and Uncle Sam never did a damn thing for me, except lie about the facts in my history, so now I'm sitting here mad cause I'm unemployed, but the government's glad cause they enjoy when my people are down, so they can screw us around, time to change the government now, Panther power, Panther power. Go toe-to-toe with the panther and you just can't win. Self-proclaimed best, suppress the rest. The rich get richer and the poor take less. The American dream was an American nightmare. You kept my people down and refused to fight fair. The Ku Klux Klan tried to keep us out.
out. We're signed to Cool and state, no, the blacks allowed. With intimidation and segregation, we're still waiting for freedom, but now we're impatient. Blacks, the others, get dead or sell out. Freedom, equality, get out, yell out. Don't you never be ashamed of what you are. It's your Panther power that makes you a star. Panther power.
Two leading constitutional scholars, David Cole and Jules Lobel, have published a critique of the Bush administration's post-9/11 policy. The book is called Less Safe, Less Free, Why America is Losing the War on Terror. Both happen to be on the board of the Center for Constitutional Rights where I work, and Jules Lobel is actually a vice president. The book, Less Safe, Less Free, points out that of the 93,000 Arab and Muslim men who underwent various special registrations, questioning, etc., by the FBI, not one, listen closely, not one has been convicted of a terrorist crime. Think about that. Meanwhile, the Department of Homeland Security continues to spend tens of millions, really hundreds of millions, on surveillance cameras and systems throughout the United States in support of their idea that somehow they can prevent, with all of this surveillance, mass arrests, mass questioning, the next act of terror. Today, we're happy to have with us Jules Lobel. He's a law professor, teaches at the University of Pittsburgh. He's also an expert on emergency powers and the laws governing war. I should just say, as a personal note, Jules and I, during the 80s, litigated not one, not two, but 14 cases against U.S. military intervention around the world. I can also say we lost them all. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Jules.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Jules, the striking thing in your book is that Bush and company have a whole new paradigm of law. And I wanted you to explain this to our listening audience, because as lawyers, we learned one thing in law school. We learned one thing in civics class, and now we've got something that completely stands it on its head. Explain what the new paradigm is.
Yeah, there's been a lot written about how the executive under the Bush administration has taken the position that they're sort of above the law. But very few people have analyzed the underlying strategy which leads to this unlawful view. And that is that the rule of law generally requires that the state not use its coercive power against either individuals or other states, unless they first show that the person has done something wrong. You can't lock somebody up unless you first show that they've done something wrong. You can't wiretap them unless you have some reasonable suspicion that they've done something wrong. And you have to prove it by some objective evidence. And you can't attack another country unless you're responding to wrongdoing by that other country, namely an attack on you or an imminent attack against you. The Bush administration now says, well, in fighting the war on terror, we're in a whole new era, and we can't rely on this normal principle. We have to go out and offensively prevent terrorist attacks from occurring, and therefore we have to operate under what we call the preventive paradigm. In fact, John Ashcroft gave it that name. And it says the state can use its coercive power not against people who are guilty of some past wrongdoing or ongoing wrongdoing, but because they have a suspicion that the person might commit some offense in the future or might know of terrorist attacks that are going on. And for example, nobody, not even the Bush administration, would justify torture as punishment for a crime or as a punitive measure. They all say, you know, we have to use these methods, which they call extraordinary methods, we call torture, as a preventive measure to get intelligence to prevent future terrorist crimes. So it's a whole paradigm shift from prosecuting people who have committed crimes to using methods that would normally be unlawful to prevent future crimes.
One thing, Jules, that I thought was striking in the book, and I think you just alluded to it, you know, I looked at these two things separately, the war against Iraq, essentially a preventive war, preemptive war, without Iraq actually having attacked us or even prepared for an imminent attack, and then the separate question of, you know, putting people in Guantanamo without any guilt just for purposes of what you call a preventive paradigm. And I think one of the strengths of the book is trying to draw those two paradigms together and say that there's some relationship in this administration.
Yeah, exactly. We try to tie together their unlawful domestic law enforcement, their unlawful use of torture both at home and abroad,
and their unlawful going to war. That this is all part of the same basic strategy and same basic dynamic. And the problem is not, of course, prevention. Prevention is a good thing. We all brush our teeth to prevent tooth decay. But what we're against is random root canals.
That's a good formulation.
You know, instead of taking preventive measures which are non-coercive, the marriage between coercion and prevention is where it becomes very dangerous.
We're talking with Jules Lobel, co-author of an important new book, Less Safe, Less Free.
I read with great pleasure your last book, where you discussed your various lawsuits against the executive in this country when they overreached and went to war without any declaration by Congress of war. You fought those fights even though you went down, because it's a fight worth doing. On this one, I think that things have evolved even further. Can you tell us what the strength of the executive branch is, say, relative to the judiciary, to the Congress, to the media, to the people as a whole? How are we in a different position now than we were, say, when Reagan was fighting in Central America?
I think Reagan was pretty bad, too. And I wouldn't say that Bush has done anything that draconian more than Reagan. But what I think he has done is taken the position that the judiciary has no role to play whatsoever. Reagan never tried to abolish habeas corpus. Reagan never, he took the position that the judiciary had a limited role to play. But this is going even further. What the preventive paradigm, the essence of the preventive paradigm, is the notion that the executive can't be overseen by any other institution, whether it be internationally the Security Council or domestically Congress or the courts. You know, you could see this in this case we're litigating now, which David Cole is going to argue about Maher Arar, the Canadian citizen who was sent to Syria.
That's the Center for Constitutional Rights case that you're referring to.
Which is being litigated by the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Jules is the vice president, and David is a cooperating attorney.
And I think you gave some legal advice in
the case. Also
members
of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm one of the attorneys with David on this case. You know, if you look at extraordinary rendition, it was used before Bush. Bush didn't come up with the idea of extraordinary rendition. It was always an illegal method, and it was used under Clinton and the first Bush presidency to essentially kidnap people and bring them to some other country where they would face trial.
You referred to it as extraordinary rendition. Wasn't it just called rendition? An extraordinary rendition is when you actually take them to torture.
Well, no, I think it was always called, they always had some kind of notion of, I'm not sure it was called extraordinary rendition, but
right.
It was illegal rendition for the purpose of trial in another country where
right.
they were alleged to have committed some crime. What the Bush administration did is take what was already a legal tactic and transform it into a preventive mode. Instead of transferring people for trial, you're now transferring people for preventive detention, essentially, and for torture, so that you can get information, or you can try to get information that they think will be helpful in preventing future terrorist crimes.
Underlying what you're saying, and I don't think it's meant to be that, is that somehow there's a sincerity of the administration in trying to come up with this paradigm as a way of making us safer. But if I look at the preventive paradigm on Iraq, for example, that we went to war, at least publicly, for their reasons, to prevent an imminent attack on the United States or dangerous attack, or to stop them from attacking us or developing a bomb or weapons of mass destruction. That was essentially BS. They went to war against Iraq. We can't all articulate exactly the reasons, but it has to do with a combination of oil, presence in the Mideast, those kind of issues. And the preventive paradigm was just put up there as a way of trying to get people to go along with an attack for really imperialist reasons around Iraq. How does your book address that issue?
Yeah, I think that obviously, in many cases, the preventive rationale is simply a smokescreen for something that they want to do for other reasons, and the war in Iraq might be a good example of this. But, you know, the trouble is that in a time of crisis or in a time where people feel an emergency, they're very susceptible to this preventive rationale. And even if it masks other reasons, we felt that you had to sort of take on what was the rationale and show why it was counterproductive, even if it was the true rationale. From our perspective, even if Bush and the company really believed that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, and if they weren't lying to us, which we think that they were, but even if they weren't, the underlying analysis is still the same. It still is illegal to engage in preventive war, and it's still counterproductive and very dangerous, as we have seen. So I think the second point of the book was really to show that these actions taken under this preventive rationale are usually counterproductive and have been counterproductive in this situation. What is viewed by many people, even people of goodwill, to be something that has some rationale to it, in fact, is counterproductive even under their own rationale. It hasn't made us safer. If you look at all the evidence, it's made us less safe. And, you know, even people like Hillary Clinton say, well, we're much safer now than we were in 2001. We challenge that view.
Jules, I was just going to say, I'm sure Bush will not like the title of your book. Hasn't he claimed, in fact, to have disrupted a number of terror plots?
Yeah, and we look at all those terror plots and say, if you look at the evidence, there's hardly any evidence that they've disrupted any terror plots. Like everything else, it's all secret. They can't tell you exactly what it is. The little that we know suggests that either these terrorist plots were just pipe dreams of somebody, like there was a plot that they claimed to have disrupted where people in Florida were going to blow up the Sears Tower. The one thing they did in furtherance of this plot was to buy combat boots. Seems like a far-fetched scheme. In terms of any real plots that have been disrupted, you would think that if they had disrupted some plots, you'd see some prosecutions. You know, when the government in the 1990s claimed to have disrupted plots, they captured the people and they prosecuted them. There's been not one single prosecution for any of these alleged disrupted plots.
But there have been prosecutions that have gone down the tubes. They haven't been very successful in those either.
But even those are mainly for material support, which aren't any prosecutions for actual attempts or conspiracies to commit terrorism. In fact, we point out in the book, there's only been one person who has been actually convicted of an attempt to commit a terrorist crime, which a plot would be, and that was Richard Reed, the shoe bomber. And he was caught not by any preventive measure, but by a observant flight attendant who noticed a strange man trying to light his shoe. So we don't think the Bush administration can take claim for that.
You do have one very significant chapter, a number of them in the book, but I think the one that we're moving toward is the chapter about what effect all these arrests, fingerprinting, discussions have had on terrorism and whether they really captured anybody. I think there's a number of 93,000 Arabic or Muslim men who've been either interviewed by the FBI, rounded up, et cetera. Can you discuss those statistics as well as the ones about criminal prosecutions?
Yeah, the statistics are that in the year or two after September 11th, they rounded up over 5,000, mainly Muslim men, on suspicion of, that they were terrorists. And if you look at today, how many of those people that they rounded up and detained, some of them for months, not a single one stands convicted of any terrorist offense. They then called in 8,000 people under a special registration program. Again, a coercive program. And again, out of those 8,000 people, not a single one has ever been convicted of a terrorist offense. If you look at all of this, 93,000 people under those programs and a questioning program, and not one single conviction for a terrorist offense, it really leaves you with the impression that they've created a lot of mistrust, a lot of anger, a lot of hostility towards the United States government. There hasn't been any tangible result from any of this.
We're speaking with Jules Lobel, who's a constitutional litigator, a professor of law at Pittsburgh, who wrote, along with David Cole, the just-released book, Less Safe, Less Free. And Jules, when I saw you last, it was just in Washington at the National Lawyers Guild 70th Convention. Saw Heidi there, too. I saw Bill Goodman, who used to be the litigation director at the Center for Constitutional Rights, of which you are vice president. And Bill said, and I thought it was very telling, that these laws and practices and procedures that the Bush people have brought in are really ultimately aimed at the movements for social justice here in the United States. And I want you to talk about that.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think the way that they're aimed at that is by essentially what they do is remove any checks on the executive. And they allow the executive free will to do what they want. In the short run and the long run, that's not going to be just turned against aliens, which were the subject of these 93,000 people who were arrested or fingerprinted, etc. but it's directed against social movements. And we know that time and time again. And you know, if you look at the way they've been using terrorism against the environmental movement, against, you know, various movements to try to deprive people of their ability to organize for social change, I think that's the ultimate aim. And that's what Cheney and Bush and that whole crowd have been up to, you know, for decades now.
Jules, what do you and David hope that this book will accomplish?
We hope it will give people an insight into this coercive preventive paradigm, but we also hope that it will challenge the perception, you know, not only Republicans, but many Democrats, particularly Democratic politicians, have that this invocation of the war on terror, national security, makes us safer. And I think once people begin to understand that it hasn't made us safer, that it's in fact led to, you know, more hostility against the United States and more terrorists being created, I think there's a chance of challenging this whole policy that is justified simply as a matter of making us safer. And that's what we're hoping to, in some way, affect that debate.
Jules, if people would like to hear you and or David speak about the book, are you touring around the country?
I know I'm speaking in San Francisco at a joint Guild CCR event November 28th, and I'm speaking at Stanford on November 27th.
So we encourage our listeners to get a hold of this book by two CCR, Center for Constitutional Rights, board members and a vice president, David Cole and Jules Lobel. We've been speaking with Jules Lobel. Less Safe, Less Free, Why America is Losing the War on Terror. You don't think we're losing it, Jules, because of the decline of American imperialism and the rise of China?
Fundamentally, we're going to lose because of that.
All right, Jules.
Jules, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, okay. Jules.
Well, thanks for doing this.
Authors, actors, and luminaries gather to explore and debate the case for impeachment of President Bush and Vice President Cheney. Joining us to give some details is Olivia Greer, Artistic Director at the Culture Project, and Alan Bushman, Creative Director at the Culture Project.
Olivia Greer, tell us why our listeners should come and what we can expect.
Well, essentially, because the U.S. government has taken impeachment off of the table, we have decided that it is within our responsibility as citizens and as artists to put it on the table for the people of this country to have a conversation and to hold their government to account. So we are really piloting a new theatrical structure, which allows us to bring in experts who are working in legal arenas, in activist arenas, to come and be in our theater to have a conversation with citizens about what this government is doing.
I saw that. You've got some wonderful actors, actresses, attorneys, Marty Garbus, Lynn Redgrave, Sam Shepard. It's really quite an amazing group of people that you've put together here. Give us some of the highlights that we can expect.
Basically, what we've done is we've inspired, in part by the Center for Constitutional Rights, five different articles of impeachment. So the Monday that you talked about, this coming up one, is focused on torture and extraordinary renditions.
And I want to remind you that that is tonight.
Basically, what you'll see is artists who will set the stage for the question of impeachment, reading from a scripted piece that draws from the Constitution, draws from people like Barbara Jordan, like Thomas Jefferson, to talk about why this is an important tool that needs to be a living tool. And then we'll focus in very, very specifically on the question of torture and extraordinary renditions, why it's illegal, why it's criminal, and why it's an impeachable offense. So that's an exciting evening. And it's, you know, we're bringing people in from a variety of different arenas. Am I allowed to say, Michael, that you're going to be trying this case for us?
Yeah, I'll try.
But we also have people from the other side of the aisle. So Bruce Fein, who is a conservative constitutional lawyer, is very much in favor of impeachment and also will be with us to talk about that. Carol Gilligan, who's a renowned scholar and psychologist, will come to talk about what the effects of this kind of government action is on a societal psyche, what it means to us as people when we watch this happening on the news and how we respond to it. So we're looking at it from a variety of aspects.
And I want to remind you that that is tonight. Tell us how you get tickets.
Cultureproject.org, and you see the big buy tickets icon. The other important thing to note is that we will be streaming all of these events on our website after the fact, so you can go to cultureproject.org and you'll be able to see what's happening in the theater as well if you're not in New York and can't come be with us in person.
And this is going to be going on, I want to remind our listeners, that is tonight, Monday the 26th, and then the next Sunday. And then
Sunday, December 2nd, we're doing a special screening of Jonathan Demme's new documentary about Katrina. It's called New Home Movies from the Lower Ninth Ward, which is interviews with people who lived and live in the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans. The Monday after that, December 3rd, we will be focused on an article of impeachment specific to Hurricane Katrina and criminal negligence in the Gulf Coast. On Sunday, December 9th, Vanessa Lynn and Corin Redgrave will all be with us to read from poems from Guantanamo, which is a collection of poems written by detainees held at Guantanamo Bay. And Mark Falkoff, who edited that collection, will also be with us. December 10th is a Monday, and we'll be focused on warrantless surveillance and wiretapping with Elizabeth Holtzman and a variety of other folks. And then our closing day, Sunday, December 16th, will be focused on the expansion of executive power, which really sort of sums up the whole thing in a lot of ways. And we'll have Marjorie Cohn and Naomi Wolf and John Nichols, who wrote The Genius of Impeachment, Jackson Brown, Sam Shepard, and a number of other pretty extraordinary folks.
Well, it sounds great, Olivia. I know the response has been amazing. I went on Sunday night. Sold out crowd, amazing performance. I mean, people are really interested in it. Bill Kunstler's daughters are actually filming it for various podcasting, so it's a great event. I really recommend it to people. So, Olivia, thank you very much. I know you were instrumental in putting it together.
Thank you guys so much. Cultureproject.org.
I guess we'll hear from Alan Bushman, the creative director, next. We had a great conversation with Olivia. Why don't you tell us something about where this idea came from and how it's doing?
Well, I think the key inspiration really came from hearing Bruce Fein on the Bill Moyer show, when it became clear to me that this was not a tactic for revenge or retaliation or punishment, but really a remedy for an executive branch that's out of control and acting unlawfully, and that there are people from both sides of the aisle that are really interested in seeing the future efforts of our current administration contained, so we don't find ourselves in more wars or more people neglected. And once I understood that it was a moral imperative and a constitutional obligation for, as a citizen, to do my part to try to bring things back to a true course, I felt this was an effective way of reaching out to people. And we're finding this extraordinarily true. The number of people that are picking up on what we're doing through the alternative media is phenomenal.
Talking to Alan Bushman from the Cultural Project. Alan, one more time, how do people get in touch with you for tickets?
The tickets are available through Theater Mania. The telephone number is 212-352-3101, or they can go to our website, cultureproject.org, and just click on Buy Tickets.
Thank you, Alan. This is great. Is there anything, the last word you want to impart to our audience on this day when you have a performance tonight?
Just come. It's so, the conversation last night after the performance was so exciting. It's everything you want. People are bottled up, and they have a chance to speak out. The question and answers with the panels are things that people dream about. It's so good. Correct. And so inspired. So,
the genius of impeachment and the genius of Alan Bushman. So.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Alan.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
That's lawanddisorder.org.